Welcome, everyone, to this edition of the Not So Common Podcast. My name is Pat Contry, and my guest this week is Kelsey Lewin. She's a retro gamer, retro collector. She appears in YouTube videos. She appears on the Metal Jesus Rocks channel, and she is co-owner of the Pink Gorilla Retro Game Stores in the Seattle area. Welcome, Kelsey. How you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I haven't seen you since Portland Retro Gaming Expo, the mecca of the retro gaming scene. How did you do out there this past fall? Did you okay?
Yeah, I did great. That's mostly a show. I mean, I go because I love it, and I would be there regardless of whether or not they wanted me there, you know? I mean, I did a couple panels this year, but I would do it even if they didn't want me there. So we had a booth.
Oh, sure.
But in general, we're mostly there to buy stuff, or at least I am. I hope to break even.
For the collection or for the store?
Yes.
Both.
Yeah, both.
Is that because there's so much opportunity to find maybe some rare or niche items that don't normally walk into the store, or is it hard to keep games in stock at Pink Gorilla?
Yeah, I mean, it's all of the above. The nice thing about the Retro Gaming Expo is sometimes you can find people on the last day who, you know, they like flew in, and so they've got boxes of stuff they really don't want to fly back with them. So you can usually strike a couple deals that way. I mean, you know, for the most part, people are selling things for just about retail or maybe a little bit under there. So it's not like going to a flea market or anything, but it's still pretty cool to find some interesting things that we don't see in very often. We've got, you know, a couple regular customers. We'll try to look for things specifically for them that they've been looking for. And, of course, for myself and the other employees.
What was your highlight item? What was the big item that you picked up this year that you're like, oh, man, this is great?
Well, it's got to be the Super Nintendo Entertainment Bike, which I won at the auction. So
you did. You did win that. And it's funny because I mentioned that to you when we were going back in our Twitter DMs about, you know, I'm like, I think I mentioned it, not realizing you're the one that won that. I was like,
yeah.
I think I remember that being there, and you actually won it.
I was like a little bit of a celebrity the next day because everyone was like, how are you planning on getting that home? Oh, you're the one that won the bike. What are you doing with that? And I'm lucky that I have a store to shove it in the back of because I definitely don't have room in my apartment for it, but...
Did you have to take it apart and transport it in the back of a truck?
So we had a like SUV with us that we had brought, but even still with all the merchandise we were bringing back, we had to take it apart a little bit. We had to take the seat off of it, and I think that was all we did actually, was just take the seat off of it. So it didn't.
So do you have the games for it?
I have
a couple of games.
I have just the mountain bike rally one. The Speed Racer combo cart is a little too rich for my blood, but
a little too pricey, right?
Yeah.
It goes for like a couple grand just for the cartridge.
Yeah.
Whatever it goes
and it's
for.
Not even any good. So, you know.
Sure. So that's a prime item that gets into the mind of how insane us retro collectors are, right? Because here's a gigantic exercise bike that is esoteric, that no one really owned back then. Probably if you bought it, you used it like 10 times before you realized, I'm not getting a good workout, it's not fun, right? So you see this item, but it is incredibly rare, and you have to have it. You just have to own it. It's like it's in front of you. You're driven to want to bid on this item. And even if you got a pretty good deal, like you even said, I don't know where I can store this item. But now you have a sought after item. I mean, so when you see something like that, what's the first thing that pops into your head when you see an item like that up
for
auction?
I'm a person who collects, I would say, primarily weird stuff. Like that's kind of my bread and butter of my collection is I collect odd things. I've got a WonderSwan fishing sonar. I've got a blood glucose monitor for the DS. I have all these like crazy things that probably sold incredibly poorly. People don't even know they exist because they're just so weird. I don't even know who they were made for, you know? So every time I see something like that, I mean, it's exciting for me. I like that kind of stuff.
It's like, I wouldn't even go after some of that stuff. For example, the Miracle Piano, I've had probably a dozen opportunities to own that in the box. And that's a big, gigantic box for that, the NES / Super Nintendo piano. And it's just so big and bulky. And I'm like, that was my sort of like my line where I was like, do I really need the Miracle Piano. I mean, I have the cartridge. Shouldn't that be good enough? But for you, like, this is, like, not a one-of-a-kind item, but there's very few of these things left out there in its original form.
And I have to be kind of choosy because, I mean, like you said, it takes up a lot of room. So I can't just buy everything enormous and rare and weird. I have to be a little bit choosy with it. I think they also had the Wii in, Exertainment bike for sale at this auction. And so I couldn't get both, you know. I couldn't justify having both the Super Nintendo and the Wii one.
What was interesting about that auction at Portland was that that's some of the heavy-hitting spenders of probably the U.S., right, that show up there. There's some, I mean, I only bid on a few things, but there was some cool stuff that went for sale. Like you said, the Wii glucose meter, which, by the way, was cheaper currently, brand new online. You could find it. I was looking at Dane Anderson from Nintendo, which next to me. I'm like, this is cheaper, right? Then can't you find this? And like, I looked on Amazon. You could have bought it cheaper on Amazon.
So that's exactly what I did. That was another one that I was bidding on, and I bought it that same weekend, but I didn't buy it at the auction because I was watching it. I had a listing up on eBay on my phone, and I was like, well, I'll bid until it's more expensive than this listing on eBay. And then it went for like twice as much as what it was listed for on eBay. So I'm like, okay, I'll just buy this one.
It's that psychology totally. Right, of the auction and the war, and you want
to. And to be fair, it seems like a very rare item, and I'm sure that it's one of those things where, you know, if someone like Jason did a YouTube video about it, maybe there's that one guy on eBay or that one guy on Amazon who still has a couple copies of it for pretty cheap, but like those will go, and then all of a sudden there's none left out in the retail world.
Yeah, but the first thing that I think of is like that's made by a major pharmaceutical company, so they made millions of those.
That's
the first
true.
Thing I thought is like if that's made by like Merck, they made millions of those. They just pumped those out.
Yeah, they might have a ton of those still left somewhere.
There's got to be new old stock somewhere. I think Dane was telling me that he saw them at his local like CVS or Rite Aid on clearance or something. Like,
really?
Like a bargain, you know what I mean? Just to get rid of them. Because how many people even that had some sort of diabetic condition maybe even knew that existed? It's like, who even knows?
Yeah, well, the packaging to me doesn't make it obvious what it is. Like, you have to actually read all of the text on it. There's not like a nice image that shows. It doesn't easily show what it is. So I think.
So if you're like a 65-year-old that has diabetes, you come home with this item. Oh, it's just like a glucose meter. Oh, I need a video game system for this? What?
And it's like gamified and stuff. I've heard that none of the strips in it, you know, the actual like reader strips will work anymore. I've heard they're all expired by now, but I'm sure you could just buy more.
Oh, sure. So how did you get into retro game collecting? What systems did you originally grow up with?
So I'm younger, so the first game thing I ever owned was a Game Boy, and it was my dad's Game Boy. So, I mean, that goes back a ways, but the first actual console, home console I had was the N64. So, yeah,
okay.
I'm young.
So that's a nice way of saying, Pat, you're old. Okay, you're... So we'll say N64 was your first home console.
Yeah.
So you are probably easily at least 12 years younger than me. So, okay, I kind of know how old you are.
I don't look it, though. Or you don't look it. One of those two. So I started...
So you grew up with the N64.
I grew up with the N64. My parents were relatively cool about video games, but they didn't want me to have more than, I think, two systems at a time. I could have one handheld and one game system, so I would always have to sell it off if I wanted the new one. So when the GameCube came out, I had to go trade in my gold Toys R Us edition Nintendo 64 for $3 to GameStop. Not even kidding.
Oh, no.
That actually happened.
Oh, no.
So I know. But after that, you know, I mean, I got basically almost every console that came out. I didn't get, you know, both the PS2 and the Xbox at the same time, but I had them both at one point or played them at neighbors' houses or whatever. But it wasn't until I was looking at colleges, actually, that I even realized that people collecting video games and old video games was a thing. So I visited Seattle, and I saw this store called Pink Gorilla Games, and I walked in, and I was like, this is awesome! At all of this like Japanese stuff and all of these, you know, old games. And I actually, while I was there, I picked up a copy of Pokemon Stadium, I think, and maybe one other game, just some games that I played as a kid. And I think that's how it starts for most people, is you're like, you find the games that you played as a kid, and then you kind of just get into it from there. You're like, you know what? It's not just the games that I played. How about all the games I didn't play? So that was when I first started getting into it. And, you know,
so
once I moved
you went
to
back
Seattle,
and recaptured. I'm sorry. You went back and you recaptured the games from your youth first.
Exactly. And I had held on to all of my Pokemon games throughout the years, on at least the Game Boy versions of all of them. You know, Game Boy, Game Boy Color, Game Boy Advance, DS. I had been playing those. I never stopped playing games, but they weren't really important for me to hold on to until I realized that that was a thing people do. And it seemed really fun to me. I don't know. I wanted to just try some games I had never tried before, and I thought it would be cool to have a small shelf full of cool old games that I had never tried. So one of the first things I bought when I moved to Seattle was a Sega Genesis, which I did not have growing up, and just got to play a bunch of the old classics. I mean, you know, I played the Sonic games via, like, the Sonic Gems collection on the GameCube and that sort of thing. And there was a Genesis at, like, a daycare I went to. So I'd played a Genesis before, but I had never owned one. That makes me sound super young, I know, but...
I was going to say, you weren't like a toddler at the daycare, were you?
No, no, no. I was... It was a daycare for, like, my dad's work. So it wasn't like a... Okay. It wasn't a daycare for, like, children, or, like, teeny tiny children. It was, I think, anywhere from, like, 4 to 8-year-olds there. So, and I was at the upper range of that, so probably 7 or 8.
Okay. So, kind of a similar story to me. Around college age, or right before it, you start to collect and get the games you had when you were a child because you had gotten rid of them. Mm-hmm. You got rid of your system. I did the same thing, except I traded mine into Funko Land. Probably 94, 95 I did that before rebuying it again a few years later. So how did you make that transition? You've made the rare, probably coveted transition of eventually becoming an owner, or at least co-owner, of a retro game store.
Yeah, it's...
So where did that lead from?
It's not a very interesting story, unfortunately. I moved to Seattle. I knew that I really wanted to work for this game store that I had visited when I first went there. So I applied and eventually got a job there and became a manager relatively quickly. Was a manager there for about 4 years or so, 4 or 5 years. And towards the end of that... the former owner, who was, you know, the original owner who founded it in 2005, he was like, you know, I really just don't want to do this anymore. He basically hadn't been doing anything anyways. You know, we sent the financial reports to him at the end of the day and that sort of thing, but that was about it. He wasn't, like, going into the stores, wasn't working in the stores, and so he just decided he didn't really want to do it anymore. And so me and one of the other managers just offered to buy him out, and that's exactly what we did. So not a super exciting story.
What year did you start working for? What year were you a co-owner?
So I've been a co-owner now for about 1.5, almost 2 years. It'll be 2 years in June, I think, or July. So 2015 or 2016, I guess, was when we took over.
Were you working for them in 2011 or no? No, okay.
No, 2012. I'm getting my years wrong a little bit here. Sorry.
That's okay. The reason I asked that because I remember, I'm trying to remember every worker, but I went to the Pink Gorilla when I was at PAX Prime 2011. That's when I did the panel with James Rolfe. We premiered the NWC video we did. And the Pink Gorilla store had one of the things I regretted, one of the very few things I regretted not buying that I passed up on. And you're going to slap me today for not buying it. But at the time, it wasn't that great a deal. There was a box, complete in box, and I mean it had everything, TurboGrafx CD system with everything in it. It had the sample CD, it had everything in the baggies, and it was only like $200, which at the time was worth a little bit more than that, but not that much more, believe it or not, only 6 years ago, or at this point, 6.5. So it was so huge, I was worried about the shipping costs. And they said they would have shipped it back for me. But I was like, eh, it's not worth it then. And I'm not getting a deal because the shipping's going to be more than on eBay. So I passed it up, and I regretted that ever since. Because while I eventually did get one in the box, it was missing like the little top styrofoam.
Yeah.
It didn't have the promo karaoke CD, which is hard to find. So I was like, no. Like, that was probably one of a few times I passed up something that got away. So I was just wondering if you were working there at the time. That's all.
No, I did PAX Prem 2012, but... Okay. I believe. I'm not great with years, but I know I started in 2012, if that helps. Because so, that was when I moved to Seattle.
So what did you quickly learn from working at a game store like that? Did you learn something more about the collecting scene, about retro gamers themselves you didn't know about?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was very lucky in that the general manager at the time was huge into the game collecting community. He had a big collection, and he basically just kind of... He saw that I was getting interested in it, and he basically just did the rest of the work, you know, just showing me what was cool, what I should pick up. And so I ended up, I mean, I spent most of my paycheck for the first probably 6 months working there just on buying fun stuff. You know, I was living in a dorm at the time. It was my freshman year of college, so I didn't have a ton of expenses after I paid, you know, after food and stuff was paid for. So I was just buying games. And got really into it. I don't really have like a... I don't think there was like one thing that really taught me everything there is to know about the game collecting community, but just the more I played and the more I saw, I got really into the weird stuff. And the first one that I can remember is kind of ironically, because we were just talking about the blood glucose thing, was Packy and Marlon. That came into the store, the Super Nintendo game that's about diabetes. And that was just like the most hilarious thing to me. I don't know why, but at the time I found that to be so interesting. I know they made a couple of those, and I know that edutainment software, I mean, I had a PC and stuff. I knew that edutainment was a thing. I just was surprised that anyone had actually put a diabetes edutainment game on a Super Nintendo. And so that was the first thing I can remember being like, I gotta have that, that's so weird.
That was probably with me, like the Bible games on the NES, the Wisdom Tree games that I had no idea existed when the NES was first out, because how would you know that?
Yeah,
once I discover them, like, I have to have every single one of those. Yeah, I have to. I mean, I went to my Funko Land every other week until I saw that bright blue Bible Adventures game on the shelf, and eventually they got it because that's the most common of those seven Wisdom Tree games, and they had it, and I was like, oh my god, I found Bible Adventures out of Funko Land. I didn't have to cheat and buy it on eBay. Like, that was a big deal. Because at the time, the game was probably like a $3, $4 game at Funko Land, or $5. You know what I mean? And it was actually one of the games on their list.
That's kind of surprising.
There was a different feeling
back
then.
Did Funko Land just take literally everything? I mean, I'm surprised that they had the Bible games that, I don't know.
I would have to look at, I do have a price newsletter still, or newspaper still, where it has Steam events for only 29 cents.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm pretty sure they have a chunk of the unlicensed games on there, because they would come in.
Yeah,
you know, they would come in. They were sold retail stores, maybe not Toys R Us, but the Tengen games were sold at Toys R Us.
Right.
But for something like a Color Dreams game or something like that, you might have to go off the beaten path, go to a mall store like Electronic Boutique or Egghead Software, Electronic Software, etc., something like that, in order to find something that was that strange. But that's what drew me in when I started learning about the weird stuff, like Wally Bear and the No Gang, a weird anti-drug game. And that's like, oh my god, not just do I want the games that, like you, the games I had as a kid, now I want the games that are also weird or things that I didn't even know existed, and get into it that way and get like drawn in gradually.
Yeah, that's definitely like a big thing for me now. It's just the weird stuff.
So your collecting career, let's just say, is about 6 to 7 years old since you've been collecting.
That sounds about right.
Okay, what have you seen in those 6 to 7 years, from say between 2010, 2011, now? What has surprised you? The trends, the changes, anything that's you know, kind of stuck out to you?
To me now, it feels kind of predictable. Honestly, I feel like I know where I know which things are going to go up in general, maybe not specific games necessarily, but I can see where, you know, the trends have gone. We had NES was really expensive for a long time. Now the games, at least the common ones, are starting to settle down a little bit. Super Nintendo is probably about the same way right now, where the common ones are starting to settle a little bit. And we've got N64 on like an all-time high, and GameCube going up, and it just seems like it's kind of doing the wave through the generations, right? Like mm-hmm. whatever people are about 20 in their early 20s to mid 20s right now, what they grew up with, that's what's going to be on the upward swing. And anything that's, you know, like the Wii, so I'm trying to pick up a bunch of Wii and Wii U stuff right now as it's cheap, because that's, you know, if you go purely by that, that's the next upward swing. And it's not because I necessarily want to like resell it or anything. It's just that I know that I would rather pay $20 for The Last Story now than the $60 I think it's going to be in 5 or 10 years, right?
So in theory, then the Wii collecting will get hot like 2024, like that's what, or 2020.
Yeah, something along those lines. And Wii's a little different because Wii has A, so much shovelware, and B, sold better than all of those other systems. So I think it is going to be a little bit different. But the Wii U is going to be an especially expensive system in the coming decades or so. As long as collecting...
You think so, just because less people bought it?
Yes. As long as collecting is still a thing. You know, a lot of people talk about the bubble bursting completely and just no one feeling into this hobby anymore. And I know that there's some of us who are never going to stop collecting. But, you know, the sort of upsurge in popularity in the game collecting community, as long as that's still a thing, I think Wii U is going to be probably the most expensive Nintendo console to collect for. But
even if they still have brand new old stock sitting everywhere, and that, you know,
well,
they never
they will have some games, but I mean, there's already some Wii U games that are over $100 that are just trash. I mean, things like the Croods and Hello Kitty Racing and stuff, those are over $100. They're shovelware, right? But there's just so few copies of them out there.
Well, the Wii U library isn't that big, right? What's the Wii U library at?
I'm not sure, but it can't be.
Let me
could
check
not
it.
Have reached 1,000.
745. So unlike the Wii, this is probably a little bit more, if you wanted to be a completionist, 745 isn't as bad
right.
than what the Wii had.
That's
so
actually,
maybe for some
that
people,
actually
like,
seems
like,
high
oh.
to me. That's surprising. I don't think I've ever seen more than 100 Wii U games in the same place before.
Let's see. Well, that would include all territories, though, too. So, yeah. So it's probably... Actually, I don't think it's that much, because I'm looking at some of that and that list that were unreleased. So, yeah, I think we're getting to a strange point in time where I think you'll have less and less collectors go for a complete set of games. So you're always going to have some people that say, yeah, I want that complete Wii set. I mean, the first confirmed one, just we talked about it on the CU podcast about 6-7 months ago, that you had someone be the first to fully document what's a complete Wii physical game collection. He was like the first guy to really do it. So
right.
It'll happen with the Wii U. It'll happen with the Switch, but it's going to get more complicated as you get towards digital versus physical, you know, and things of that nature. What games only came out of one or both? What does it mean to have a complete set if you get it in digital? But I think, at least in my opinion, we're going to get to that point where it's going to be just less and less people will want a full set of games.
I totally agree with that, because it's the newer stuff is, yeah, I mean, like you said, there's thousands instead of what it used to be, like, you know, 600 or 700 games released for a system. I mean, look at the DS. There's some games on there that still, I think there's an Animaniacs game that people aren't really sure if it exists or not, because no one's really found a copy yet, but all signs point to it have existed. So I know a couple people with complete DS collections, but they're missing that one. That one and maybe one or two more that are like, these I think exist, but we haven't quite confirmed it yet. So
it's sort of like the Atari 2600 set. Oh. There's no one that has a full 2600 set.
I mean,
set.
What even would be... Because at what point do you draw the line? You know, if you had to mail order
exactly.
it, was it someone's garage? I mean, does that count? So
yeah. Do you have to have Red Sea Crossing and Gamma Attack? What about the birthday card?
Right.
You know, and at that point, we're talking about games that there's only a few confirmed to exist for about a handful of games. So it's nearly impossible for even one person to have one of each of all of those.
Right.
And so one of the biggest collectors is Rich Weiss, and he one of the biggest Atari 2600 collectors in the world, if not the biggest, and he doesn't have a complete
Atari. I think he does have the literally most complete Atari 2600 collection in the world, but I know he's missing Birthday and probably, I think, Red Sea Crossing as well. So, but he, I mean, he has Air Raid. He has a couple of the incredibly, like, there are only three in the world type things.
Oh, yeah. It's such a weird thing. Because, yeah, like I said, people were making them in their basement and advertising in a magazine that, like, 10 people saw that advertisement and, like, 4 people ordered it.
Right.
So does that really count, in essence?
Yeah.
You know, it's a weird question to ask and gets at maybe the heart of the psyche behind our OCD of wanting to complete a collection. Right.
That's why I've never tried. Oh, actually, that's not true.
Never tried.
I have... I forgot. I'm going for a complete Wonderswan collection, but that's... That's doable.
Well, how big is that, though?
I mean, 220-ish.
Oh, that's not bad. That's like Ian going after his...
Yeah, there's a couple games in there that are going to be basically impossible. Tenori On, which is more like a music program than it is a game. There's only 120 of those in the world, and they were sold at an art exhibit in Japan.
Wow.
And then the Mama Mite Wonderswan, which was a pregnancy tracker for the Wonderswan. And I have been told by people in Japan who are big Wonderswan collectors to give up. You are never going to find it.
How many did they make of that one?
No one knows, but there have been like a few found. And most of the ones that have been found are like yellowed and like really gross. So
one level above a guy making Atari games in his garage in 1983.
Yeah,
one level above that.
Yeah, they were apparently sold in, like, I guess Japan has pregnancy stores. I don't think we have those here. Like stores that are specifically for, you know, it's got all the things you would need throughout being pregnant.
Not just stuff for the baby, but pregnancy.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, like, I don't even know what you would find there. I guess like vitamins, prenatal vitamins, and swaddling blankets,
apparel and clothes.
Like,
yeah, yeah.
You know, that sort of thing. So, I guess that's where they were sold. That's what I've been told. There's very, very little information about it online. So,
do you see there being more? I made the argument with Ian before that. I think he kind of agrees that Nintendo consoles in and of themselves have a quote-unquote more collectability and will going forward than, say, someone trying to get a whole PS2 collection or Xbox 360 because of the exclusivity of those primary games that everyone knows and loves, first-party games. And the fact that, you know, Nintendo's sort of like the Disney of video games, so that's always going to have that special appeal.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we had a complete original Xbox collection in the store at one point. Someone traded in every single game, all 800 or 900. I can't remember the exact number anymore.
Wow.
But yeah, every original Xbox game that was released in the States, as well as, they didn't have Metal Wolf Chaos, but they had a couple of the Japanese exclusives. So, but I mean, it was neat for people, and we sold a couple of the rarer ones pretty quick. You know, Stubbs the Zombie and that sort of thing went relatively quick, but you know, so much of it sat around, and I'm sure we still have some of the sports games and that sort of thing that were traded in. And that
you
was,
have like 2/3 of the library still sitting.
Yeah, I mean, it's just not as exciting for people. And I try to, especially for original Xbox, because I think it's a great console. I try to turn people on it more often, just because it's, you know, you can get the console with all the hookups for like $35. You can get plenty of really good games for under $10. And you can find them at thrift stores pretty often, too. You know, much
they
more
give
so.
Away. Flea markets,
yeah.
I mean, $1 each for Xbox games. Like, they can't get rid of them.
If you go to something like the Portland Retro Gaming Expo, you'll see a lot of booths that have their PS2 and their original Xbox sections, with, you know, with the exception of just a couple of the actually rare, sought-after ones. They'll just be like, you know, pick any 3 for $10 or whatever. Pick any, you know, $4 for $10, dollar each, whatever. So even at retro game collecting shows, it's still really cheap. So I always encourage people, if they want to just build a collection pretty quickly, I'm like, start with those consoles. There's like actually good games for them, plenty of them, and they're cheap.
Along those lines, do you see there being people eventually wanting to collect, for example, like the PS2 has like 2,500 games. Anyone that would try to do a complete PS2 set, or just say, oh, I want to collect subsections, maybe get all of the RPGs or all these certain games. Do you see there being a love for like a console like the PS2 itself versus just the titles that appeared on it?
Yeah, I see. I mean, there's a ton of people I know who collect just the PS2 RPGs. In fact, I'm one of them. Well, not just, but I have almost all of the PS2 RPGs, or all the PS2 horror games, or all the PS2 fighting games, or something like that, because those are genres that the PS2 is very strong in, right? But I haven't seen a lot of people going for a complete PS2 collection. And, you know, one, because it's really daunting, like you said, 2,500-ish games. It seems nearly impossible. Plenty of those games are, like, bad and just uncommon, too. I mean, things like, you know, some of the old or newer sports games on them, like Madden 11 came out on the PS2. And it's like $12, but why would you want Madden 11 on the PS2? for most people, right? So, although I've seen a couple people go for it, I mean, it's certainly not a console that a lot of people are trying to collect everything for.
They still may. Let's see. The last game was FIFA 14. Is that right? So there was a 2013 PS2 game.
I think that was just in Brazil, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, it's a daunting library, and the collectability to me, something like that, is down for a few reasons. One, we're talking about a massive amount of sports games, just a massive amount in general. When you talk about that, there's like 14 different FIFA games. Have fun. There's, you know, twice as many baseball games because you have more than one company making it. It's just insane. And plus, not just that, the love of these systems, going back to exclusivity, it's like well less than 50% of this library is exclusive.
Oh, yeah.
So you get to that point, what exactly are you saying? You're collecting, oh, I can get this game not just on the Xbox. It was on the PC. It might also appear even on the GameCube. So it's just less and less special at that point, right? If it appears on 4 to 5 different types of, you know, consoles or PCs, to me, it doesn't make much sense to go for the full library, at least in my opinion. It's sort of like it's lost more and more that sort of special collectability of the system.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I really don't see non-Nintendo systems, at least the common non-Nintendo systems, getting anywhere near the amount of love that the Nintendo does. I mean, you have people going for like full TurboGrafx collections and that sort of thing, but those are sort of off the path, not, you know, not quite as common. Everyone had a PS2, right? It sold 120 million units. That's insane. I mean,
cheap DVD player.
Yeah,
you had to get it back then.
So there's so many of them out there.
I'm not sure you remember DVDs. You're kind of young. You might remember.
Oh, come
DVDs.
On! I remember VHS. Not that young.
But that was a big draw back then,
mm-hmm.
Because DVD players, to put in perspective, when the PS2 came out, I think it was it 200 or 250 for it?
I can't remember.
Retail.
But yeah.
But DVD players were about the same amount or more.
Right.
So from a lot of people's perspective, this is why Sony was smart. It was like, well, you're going to buy a DVD player anyway, so you're getting a DVD player with the game console.
Yeah.
And that was a very large draw back in like 2000 and 2001.
And even if you're not a big gamer, I mean, people who, they were going to get a DVD player anyway, and they're not a big gamer, but they're like, but you know what? I really like football. Maybe I'll just pick up the PS2 and like one Madden game, you know? I'll try it out. It's the same amount of money. You know?
I would love to know. I would love to know if they ever released it or how to know what the average amount of attach rate of games was per PS2. I can almost guarantee you that like there were so many. Maybe like 20% of those 120 million people bought like one or two games and just kept it as a DVD player, and they were satisfied with it. I mean, me personally, I think I own maybe 2 or 3 games. I got it primarily as a DVD player.
Really?
And I got one of those weird online deals where it's like, oh, do these like, it was one of those things that existed 15, 16 years ago and like internet barely 2.0, where it's like, oh, try all these trial offers. And at the end, if you complete them all, you can get a free PS2, or you get it for only $40. I actually did one of those.
And it was not a scam, and it didn't steal your credit card info?
As far as I know, didn't. Young, plucky college Pat did not get his credit card stolen. But you had to, like, go through and do all the cancellations of, like... Like, one of them was, like, sending you basically speed or amphetamine. Just like, oh, this is a weight loss thing. Sign up and get a free bottle. But you got to cancel within 30 days or we'll send you another one for $20. So you had to go and cancel, like, 8 different things. But the PlayStation 2 did come. It did arrive. And I remember buying one of the SmackDown games. I bought, like, 2 of the SmackDown versus Raw games. Like 2003 or something, 2004. Here Comes the Pain, one of the most famous ones in the franchise, like the second or third one they made. And they were great games, but I remember saying, it's like, yeah, this is great just to have a DVD player, because I had a lot of cash when I was like 20 years old.
Yeah.
21. I can blow on just a $200 DVD player by itself. And even if the interface was clunky to play DVDs, they sold that remote separately, you know, and that was all you needed in order to navigate it. So now we're going off on the PlayStation memories. When the video game years comes back, video game years 2000, we'll talk about how that was a big one. But how did you get into, speaking of video game years, how did you get into the online video creation aspect of what you love?
So it started out just me and the other owner of Pink Gorilla. We started doing a podcast together. We just decided, you know, we're constantly talking about all of this stuff. I mean, it's the same way everyone starts a podcast, right? Oh, we're always talking about this. We should just record it and put it on the internet. So that's sure. Basically exactly what we did. And we argue a lot, like in a good-natured way, but we argue a lot. So we decided we'd do something where we're just arguing two different sides of an issue. And that's not really what the podcast is anymore, but that's sort of what it began as. I think the first one we did was, are toys to life here to stay, or is it just a passing fad? You know, we did some digital versus physical media discussions, and you know, I enjoyed doing that. It was going decent enough, you know, considering I was basically a nobody. You know, no one had ever heard of me, but it got a handful of listens and was doing okay. And then Jason, Metal Jesus, had actually started listening to it, and I did not know that. We were like friendly acquaintances at the time. We weren't friends, but you know, he came into the store, we had good conversations. You know, if I saw him on the street, we would smile and wave, and that was about it. But he started listening to it and he enjoyed what he heard, and so he invited me to come do a couple videos with him. So we did that. Those went pretty well, I guess, because he kept inviting me on. So that was really my first foray into the video creation part. And, you know, I wasn't doing any of the actual creating at the time. I was just sort of, you know, show up with your knowledge and let's talk about this thing. But I was really enjoying it. And because I had gotten so into, like, the weird stuff, I was buying all of this. Like, we did a video on the WonderSwan, which is one of my favorite consoles. And I had all of this weird stuff, and I started thinking, you know, I did a kind of an overview video about this, but what if I was able to go a little bit deeper into some of these really odd things I own, like the Famicom modem or, you know, just things like that, right? So interesting, weird things that I didn't see a whole lot of information on online. So that was the first thing I started doing, was I just wanted to talk about some history of odd objects. But I am a perfectionist, so instead of just talking about it and talking about what I knew, I started doing about 40 to 50 hours of research per video. And, you know, if you...
Wow.
Yeah, if you see my videos, they're like 6 minutes long. So I do an insane amount of work.
A lot packed in.
Yeah, I do an insane amount of work just to bring one or two new facts, right? Like a couple things you can't find on Wikipedia, a couple things you would have to actually search through Japanese newspapers and translate to know, right? So that's what I'm trying to do. And it's a lot of fun for me, but
wow,
it does take a really long time.
So you have to go find some Japanese periodical website and then get it translated.
Yeah,
and
I've been lucky.
The information.
I've been lucky because I went to the University of Washington. They've got a great, great library there. So I've been able to search through, you know, press releases from the late 80s and that sort of thing. And You know, the Internet Archive is another great resource. So I'll go and find old Japanese blog posts and find their photos and stuff of these things and their experiences and be able to bring some of that over. But it's, you know, it takes a lot of digging. But I like the digging part. So I don't mean that to sound like, oh, God, it's just so much work for me. I really enjoy the dig. It just takes a long time.
Give me one fact that you uncovered from one of your topics that you researched that was not known, at least on Wikipedia, to the larger audience.
Sure.
So let's hear it. Let's hear one.
Yeah. So here's one from a video that has not come out yet. So this is
teaser.
It's an exciting one.
Spoilers.
So I'm doing a video on the Super Nintendo Entertainment Bike, and I found
interesting.
Yeah, I know. Wonder why. So I found an article from Arnold Schwarzenegger, that had a quote from Arnold Schwarzenegger, quote about the Extertainment Bike from Mr. Terminator himself. That's, yeah. It's not.
That's insane.
It's not like a super exciting quote, but the fact that Arnold Schwarzenegger was aware of the Super Nintendo Extertainment Bike enough to have an opinion on it is a fun fact for me.
I think it's good that the kids are playing these games and they're using their muscles at the same time.
That's basically exactly what it was. It was talking about how kids are easily bored with working out and how he was excited to see how this would, you know, motivate them to work out more.
That's actually a pretty good take on it at the time.
Yeah.
You know, for like the early 90s. That's actually not bad.
So
I might have to ask you. Maybe bribe you to maybe write something for a certain Super Nintendo guidebook talking about the Entertainment Bike. Sounds like you're the person to ask about that.
We should also write to Arnold Schwarzenegger, though, too. That would be...
If he remembers it. You think they gave him one, and he used it once and broke it with his massive thighs and just, like, crunched it, and while he's playing Speed Racer on the bike and pedaling?
Right.
I'm not sure that's supposed to even work, by the way. You're pedaling and playing Speed Racer.
Flintstones car, I guess.
So it's not just enough that you want to talk about the retro games. You actually wanted to add knowledge to the community and to educate, you know, on a topic that you thought, maybe they need to learn more about this.
Yeah, so my favorite part, actually, the last video I did, and unfortunately it was a couple months ago. I really wish I was uploading more, but it just takes so much time. The last video I did was on the Sharp NES TV, you know, the TV with the built-in NES. And I did a lot of research on it, but in the very end, there were still a couple things that I could just not find conclusive proof of. You know, I don't want to just take someone's word for it on a blog. I want to see an actual, like, brochure that proved this existed, or an ad or something like that, right? So as...
Without seeing it, was it the second version?
No, that one, there's proof that that exists. There's pictures of it and stuff. But it was a Taiwanese, I think. I'm going to make myself sound stupid here because it's my own video. They released the TV, the Famicom version of it, in Taiwan under a different name. And all I could find proof of was one size of it, one size and one color. Now, there were a couple blog posts saying that they had seen like a gold one or they had seen a different size one, but I had no proof of that and I didn't want to be like, yeah, it totally exists because some guy in Taiwan said so, you know?
Some guy said so, right?
Yeah. So
I think
I said that in my video. I said, you know, this is the only one I was able to find proof of existing. But, you know, if anyone has actual proof that there was more than one color, like, you know, as this guy says, show it off. So sure enough, after about 2 days of that video being up, some guy in Taiwan scanned his brochure that he had of this Taiwanese release of the NES TV. And yeah, sure enough, both colors existed and two different sizes existed.
And that was a Famicom, the same one
the Famicom one. So, but that was exciting to me because that literally was nowhere on the internet. This guy just dug out a brochure he personally had. And so I was able to, by asking this question, the most obscure, not important knowledge, whatever, but I was able to add a piece of knowledge to the greater community now by doing that. So that was really encouraging for me, and I want to keep doing that and asking questions that haven't been conclusively answered to see if somebody just has it laying around. right?
Sure. So you found it in a brochure. Does that mean that it got to market and people bought it? I mean, that's the next probably the next step.
It had like prices and stuff on it. I mean, I guess if there's pictures and prices, I'm going to say that at the very least it was created.
Planned.
At one point,
it was
right?
Planned. At least there was a prototype they planned for right. Enough to do the brochure.
Right.
Sure. So at least it got to that point. But now it's, I would say, yeah, who owned it? Did anyone actually sell any? You know, if none exists, that could be an indication that maybe they didn't or it was a very limited quantity, you know.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. I mean, the...
You're getting there, though. You're building the case.
Right. Yeah. It's certainly more than we had, at the very least, you know. It was much better than just some guy saying he saw one.
Which is what always upset me about stadium events forever, was that the misinformation and false information that was out there forever about this game, where it's like, yeah, it was a test market game. It's like, what is that based on? Yeah, it was recalled by Nintendo.
Right.
Really? What are you basing that on exactly? And it wasn't based on anything.
Yeah.
It was based on absolutely nothing.
Yeah, these stories tend to build like that. You know, someone says it and you say it, you know, and then someone else repeats that. And someone else repeats that. And eventually that just becomes the story. And you see that on like an extreme scale with stuff like E.T. ruining the video game industry, you know? The fact that anyone could even believe that one game can crash an entire market is ridiculous, but, you know, it was repeated enough times that's what people think, right?
You're talking about E.T.?
Yeah.
The video game crash?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and that was the wrong game to choose. They should have chose Pac-Man. They're going to choose one.
Right?
You know, they chose the wrong one. You know, they chose one that sounded cool on paper versus the one that made more sense, that people were massively disappointed of the arcade version versus the home console, you know, and the game that people were waiting for more so than any other video game.
Yeah,
probably the mid 80s. And then but hey, we talked about that in the video game year segment about that was a combination of lots of factors.
Oh yeah.
You know,
one of my favorite things that the Video Game History Foundation has done, just as like, you know, writing articles or whatever, is they actually compiled a bunch of the reviews of E.T. at the time. Yeah, they found a ton of reviews from different publications and magazines, and overall it was, the general consensus was like, it's all right. So I don't think an all right game can crash a whole industry, right? So anyways,
all right for a 25-year-old video game reviewer might be different than that 5-year-old
who
doesn't understand the game mechanics.
What I mean is, like, it was all right. That's what the people believed at the time, what the reviewers of the time, the publications all the way back from, you know, 1982, 1983, that's what they were reviewing it as. They said it was pretty good when it came out. So...
Sure.
You know.
But then time changes a story, and then a certain, you know, video game reviewers come up and do their version of it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And then, so it changes. There's, like, for example, just because James, as AVGN, says Ninja Turtles on the NES is a bad game, it becomes all of a sudden almost gospel to people that didn't grow up with it to say,
right.
Oh, yeah. Ninja Turtles was a bad game. Well, no, it wasn't a bad game. It was a good game. It was very much enjoyed at the time. It was a very hot seller when it came out. You know, it's revisionist history. The same way where people say, oh, Zelda 2 is such a bad game, or it's not a real Zelda game. No, no one thought that at the time.
Yeah,
no one said Zelda 2 is not a real Zelda game. Zelda 2 was highly thought of and rated. The same with Super Mario 2. So... You have this different generation of gamers that they may not have grown up with it, trying to apply their current knowledge to the culture.
Right.
Back at the
time. I don't think it's their fault. I don't think that they go on there and say, everyone hated this. It's more just that they hate it now, and so people apply that. They're like, oh, well, if it's bad now, it must have always been bad, right? I mean, it's the same game.
They find that echo chamber where everyone says the game's bad. They find the chamber where it said, oh, Zelda 2 is not a real Zelda game. Because they grew up with everything from Ocarina of Time onward. So they can't go back and play a previous game that doesn't fit with their mentality of what a quote-unquote Zelda game should be.
Right.
And it's just sort of a, you know, it's one of those weird things. But Zelda 2, I love Zelda 2. I cried waiting for it to come after school. Not bad.
but, you know, I didn't grow up with NES games, so the flaws are more obvious to me playing through later And it's the same way, you know, like if for people who didn't grow up with N64, they're going to see the flaws a lot better than I do, you know.
All right.
There's a nostalgia bias for sure, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the game is bad. It just means that, you know, a game
we're
that...
gonna be throwing down over Zelda 2.
I think it's a decent game. I just compare
decent
for me playing both the first Zelda and the second Zelda. I had more fun with the first, and this is as someone coming in, you know, decades after it was released, right? So it's not fair for me to rate them on the same plane because I enjoy them in different ways and I wasn't there, you know? Had I played the first Zelda and been, like, extremely excited about it in the 80s and, you know, awaiting Zelda 2, I probably would have had a lot more fun with it. I would, and, you know, as a kid, again, you just have fun with the games that you like. You know, you like Zelda, therefore, of course, you're going to like Zelda 2.
Have you encountered anything being a female in the retro gaming community scene that maybe a male would not have encountered, whether it was working at a store or doing these videos?
You know, the general stuff you'd probably think of. I get a fair amount of people who, you know, would rather speak to a male coworker or something like that. But it's not that it happens super often, and they usually pretty quickly realize that I know what I'm talking about. YouTube has surprisingly been extremely, extremely positive for me. I get some odd sexual comments, but I really don't get the "she doesn't know what she's talking about" thing, which is nice. And I really strive for that because, you know, female or not, obviously, I'm doing all this research. I really want to come across as this is as complete of a story as I could possibly tell about this item, right? Like, I've done all the research. I'm now getting to the point, I wasn't doing this in my early videos and I really regret it, but I'm now getting to the point where I'm trying to actually source my, you know, like cite my sources and list where I found a lot of this stuff. Now, some of it's going to be blocked off. You know, access to it is limited because I had to use like a university library to get access to some of these things. You know, press releases or articles from the 1980s or something, not everyone can access that for free. But I try to cite it anyway, so that, you know, if you ever wanted to go inside a library and get access to that sort of thing, you could. And check me.
No one knows how to use a library anymore. I always say I was one of the last generations that had to do research pre-internet and then kind of use the internet for a little bit. But yeah, it's interesting. Do you see the range of behavior and reaction towards a female retro gamer being different in person versus on Twitch or on YouTube, or is it the same sort of range of some nastiness? Most people are cool, but there's some people that are a little bit, you know, on the fringe, we'll just say.
Yeah, it's hard to say nowadays because, the last couple of years, people have recognized me from doing stuff either on my own channel or on the Metal Jesus channel. So
you built your street cred up. So they're like, okay, she's cool. She's one of us.
I think no one really sees me as like random female retro gamer now. I'm like a, you know, they know who I am in these like niche communities. Of course, I'm no celebrity, but in the niche community of retro game collecting, for the most part, I haven't run into it a whole lot anymore. But I can't recall a time. You know, I would love to like be able to play the victim card, I wouldn't love to play the victim card, but I can't really. I mean, yeah. I haven't had a ton of negative experiences. The only negative experiences I have are like exactly what you would expect. You just have someone who it doesn't matter who you are or what you look like. They just decided many, many years ago that you can't know what you're talking about because you're a female. But it's, sure. You know, they're the minority for sure.
Yeah, I think we're at a slightly different place now where I think in the retro gaming community, there's been less of an overall, maybe I'm being naive, less of an overall boys club mentality versus the modern gaming scene in general, maybe. Maybe because in general, retro gamers are a little bit older and more mature in general.
Yeah.
So it would be a little bit more, yeah, who cares if she's a woman, if she likes playing retro games, you know, there's not like... We don't have to haze her. She has to pass some sort of like retro gaming IQ test to be one of us. You know, it doesn't matter.
Right.
You know? I mean, that's what happened though when we got 8-Bit Alley on. the video game years, because we didn't know, because let's be honest, there's not that many female retro gamers compared to males.
No, there's not.
And so when you go to YouTube, gamers, there's very few in general.
Yeah, when it's regular gamers, it's a much more close split. But in the retro game community, yeah, there's really very, very few of us.
Yeah, so when we got Allie on Video Game Years, and she's fantastic. She's funny and witty, and she knows what she's talking about. You got the reactions where, oh, you just have her on because she's a woman, or you just want to have her on, you know, for this and that. And it's like, you know, it doesn't hurt that she's a woman. We'd rather not just have all men on, but she actually knows what she's talking about. Yeah. She's funny.
I get that occasionally. Some people accuse Jason of, which is so odd to me, they say that he uses me for clickbait. But that's so odd to me because I, A, appear in all of the videos, so it's not clickbait, and B, I'm usually talking more than he is. So again, not clickbait, because you're not, like, baiting anything. What you see in the thumbnail is exactly what you're going to see in the video.
Well, I was going to say, what are you baiting? The fact that you're not a guy, so if guys see you, might want to click on it? Is that the bait?
I don't know.
Doesn't that say more about the reaction and calling it clickbait versus you being in the video? Like, yeah, that's kind of a weak sort of self-centered argument, in my opinion.
Again, it never made any sense to me. So although it happens sometimes, it's always so, like, out of left field and doesn't make any sense and doesn't have any merit that I mostly just ignore it. It's like, you know, if you truly think that a video that has my face on it in which I star and do most of the talking is clickbait, then, like, you just... I don't even know how to respond to that. Yeah, like, I can't refute that.
I can admit I've had clickbait thumbnails on my videos before, so I can admit that, like, when that's happened. But I think it's, in general, though, I think with the internet and the retro game community, we've found each other more easily because, and obviously there's a lot more retro gamers now and collectors than there were even in 2011 versus 2008 and 2004. Right. So, I mean, when I was collecting, I was one of maybe two people I knew, like, in reality, not on the internet, that collected games. We just didn't exist.
Yeah.
And so when you meet more people, and it's like, I think, at least with the retro gaming community, when I go to a convention, I don't care, man, woman, whoever, if I see someone looking at games and appreciating that, hey, these are 30-year-old games, like, I'm like, holy shit, I found someone that thinks crazy like me that wants to look at this dead old physical media, you know, and want to collect it and appreciate it. So I'm actually happy to see other people looking at those games and appreciate that we all come out and, you know, are sharing this love of it. I'm going to start singing Kumbaya soon about that.
No, it's great. I mean, and I think the amount of retro game shows that are popping up around too is really helping the hobby, because now people are not just doing it from their homes and chatting, maybe, like, you know, maybe they're in a Facebook group or something, but now they can actually go out somewhere and meet other people who collect like they do. So I think that's the biggest strength of the retro game shows to me, is just that it's a lot better of an experience than just existing on these collecting Facebook groups or these, you know, online communities.
Oh, sure. In-person interaction is always nice. You know, it's always good to sit down. Like, for example, Segway, like we did at Retro Gaming Expo with Frank Cifaldi to talk about, you know, where the future of retro game collecting might be going in physical media. And that was a very interesting conversation. We didn't always agree 100%. But, you know, it's good to, I think, address that, not elephant in the room, but, you know, where exactly, and I'll just ask you, where the future of the retro gaming scene will be in 15 years or so, or 20 years, and what will retro game stores look like? And will there be as many that exist? And to me, those are very interesting questions for a lot of different reasons.
Yeah, I agree. It's hard to say, just because, you know, it's naive to say that everything is going to last forever, but we do have a really nice community of people who, you know, even though some people get out, it seems like they always kind of come back in a little bit. So maybe there'll be less people collecting full sets. Maybe there'll be more people shedding kind of the bulk, and the price of the common games will go down a little bit. But I would be really surprised to see that even after 15 years that this hobby has gone away completely, because it's been growing since 1999, really. I mean, when there was, like, World of Atari and... the earliest gaming expos or retro gaming quote unquote expos. It's, you know, it's only grown exponentially from there. So I think as for game stores, it's going to be important for them to diversify a little bit, because I don't think that, you know, right now we do great selling a bunch of common games and not common popular games, like even common, you know, unpopular games, things like Silent Service on the NES and all that, like those still sell. And I think they're...
I love Silent Service. Actually, it's a good game. We should learn how to play.
I think there may be a point eventually where those won't pay the bills anymore. You know, those won't be able to move quite so much. So being able to offer other things to your customers is going to be important. I mean, you know, we sell like trading cards, Magic and Pokemon and that sort of thing, and even something like that is gonna help out the overall health of retro game stores, you know.
Sure, sort of following the same trend of GameStop. We walk into a modern GameStop, less and less of it's actually video games, where you have a lot of ThinkGeek items, because they're owned by the same parent company. You have T-shirts, you have the little Mega Man 8-bit pixel figure sitting there. You have the Star Wars lamps and stuff. You know what I mean? Like, it's, you have to diversify. It's a celebration of geek culture. In this case, I always talk about how something like the Retro Gaming Expo will transform gradually into more of a celebration of the culture of retro gaming, not necessarily just collecting physical media that existed 20 and 30 years ago. It'll be, oh, well, I love Super Mario Brothers, and I love Legend of Zelda, I love arcades, and that's what it becomes. It's sort of a gradual shift. As children grow older, they'll at least love the culture, if not the physical media of a 30-year-old console, which is just as important. It's more important to love the art behind, I think, those games and what it means culturally.
Oh, yeah,
I think that's
absolutely
where we're headed. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, being able
Hancock,
to...
Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying, like, when I spoke to John Hancock, he's definitely seen a halt in the progression of prices, at least for like NES games, and you alluded to that. And if he thinks it peaked in like summer 2016, and some of the evidence does bear that out, that for a chunk of the games, they tapered off and have come down since then. Even popular stuff like Contra, for example, or DuckTales, where they hit their peak. The frenzy's over. Now it's sort of leveled off. And this was the first year in 2000. I'd say 2017 was the first year that I saw NES games starting to be treated like the common Atari 2600 games that you can't give away. It was the first year where I saw dollar bags of NES games, or $2 or 6 for 10. First year I saw it happen was 2017. I can say that with confidence. I saw that at multiple conventions.
And that's super new, like you said. I mean, that was definitely not, you know, we're still able to sell in a game store a lot of the really common games just to people who pick up, you know, maybe they pick up their childhood stuff, but some of them are collectors, and then some of them are like, you know what, I'm going to pick up, like, one random game that I don't remember or something like that. And so they still sell okay, but, you know, yeah, the fact that you're starting to see them do some of the kind of how Atari games are treated, like you said. I wonder if that means it's going to hit that place that Atari's hit, or if it, you know, or if it'll still stay a few steps above that. My feeling,
yeah,
my
it's
gut
interesting
feeling
question,
is the latter, but
Atari, I mean, Atari games are much more primitive. They don't have the characters easily recognizable. Atari's basically dead as a company. I don't care how many Atari boxes or watches they throw out there. No one really, truly cares about them. You know, so you're always going to have, oh, it's on the NES. That's always going to think going to mean something, because more than 2600, because when you think of retro gaming, almost everyone immediately goes to the NES as the primary retro gaming system. For the most part, that might change in 10 years, but for now, it's still the NES. But that said, there are a lot of games that they made a ton of on the NES that no one refers back to anymore as saying, I want to play or collect that game. For example, Silent Service, they sold a ton of them. That was a very popular game in the 80s, but no one necessarily wants to go back and play it on the NES. No one really wants to go back and play Bases Loaded or Bases Loaded 2. anymore.
Right. I have it sold a ton at the time, 80 copies of NES Play Action Football. So
exactly. now these aren't necessarily all terrible games. I think I rated Play Action Football 2 stars in a certain NES guidebook. But does anyone want to play it or own it anymore? And when you, once you get a bunch of those type of games, either you sit on them forever at $3-4, or you move them at $1 and hopefully someone buys them, like all those copies of Missile Command for the 2600 or Combat that exists,
right?
Or Pac-Man you can't sell. I do think that will happen. Maybe not for the majority of the NES library, but for a couple hundred NES games, absolutely, it's possible.
Yeah,
that we'll get to that point. Not saying Contra's ever going to be a $2 game.
No, of course not. But I mean, there's still plenty of Atari games that are, well, there's plenty of Atari games that are worth a ridiculous amount, and then there's plenty in that mid-range that will probably never dip much below $8 or so, you know? But
Centipede?
Right. So, you know, there's definitely, it's definitely starting to skew that direction, but I agree with you that I don't think it's ever, like, the whole library is never going to hit Atari levels. I think it'll probably just be the Silent Services and the NES Play Action Footballs and the Bases Loaded, you know, on that library that are going to maybe, you know, wind up in the 50-cent dollar bin eventually.
I think you might get, we might disagree a little bit, I think you'll get a little bit above that, where you're going to get maybe those games that might be fun and somewhat coveted, but they just made super, like, just too many of them to exist, you know, or at least they don't care about anymore. Like, okay, like RoboCop.
Sure.
You know, it's like, it's not a terrible game. There's some value to owning RoboCop, but I'm not going to pay $7 for RoboCop.
Right.
You know, it's because who's going to do that? Not many people. Or like Bad Dudes. Like, Bad Dudes is a kind of a game people know, but is that going to be a $10 game ever? Probably not. You know, it's just, there's certain games. But yeah, I don't think it's going to be like the Atari, though, where the majority of the library becomes a $1 or $2 game.
Yeah.
Where it's like all these common games are not worth anything. You can't give them away. Like when I was at Classic Game Fest in Austin, and there was literally, it had to be over 1,000 to 1,200 Atari games in gigantic boxes that were like 4 feet high boxes by like 6 feet. There was four of those boxes filled with 2600, some 5200, and Atari computer games, $1 each.
Like,
you could have drowned in them.
Oh,
no, $1 each per game. Every I need not for $1 for the whole box. You
like,
buy it and hopefully make your money back.
Yeah, no. Like, I'll just sell.
But a dollar per game. $1 per game for 1,000 games that they've compiled is probably this game store over the past 10 years that no one wants. They just don't want them.
And yeah, I feel bad when people bring in Atari games, and you know, I usually have a longer discussion with them than I do with other people, because I in no way want to rip anyone off, and I don't want to make anyone feel like what they had or their childhood is like worthless. So what I usually do is I bring out one of my giant Tupperware boxes full of Atari games, and I say, you know what, like, these are cool, and if, you know, if there's a couple games in there, like maybe Taz or Burger Time or something like that, where it's like worth $6 or $7 instead of I can't give it away, then I'll pay fair on those. But everything else, I'm like, I like at this point can't even pay you for Combat. Like, I have like 200 copies, and I will never sell any of them. They don't even sell at 50 cents. Like, I cannot, you know?
You don't need Atari Circus. You have enough of those.
Yeah.
Right?
So there's
Backgammon, or was Backgammon one? One of those?
Yeah. Yeah. So, and for things that I have less than 5 copies of, I will totally still pay for them and stuff. It's just, you know, for stuff like Combat, I'm at the point where I can't justify spending really anything on them anymore. And so I tell them, like, hey, you are under no obligation to, like, you know, please, by all means, try to go find someone who will pay good money for these. I just, you know, here is what I have. Here's what I haven't been able to move for years and years. So I can't. I'm sorry, you know. But I hope
they both will understand and just start yelling at
you.
How dare you?
99% of the time it goes well and they understand. you know, you have the occasional person, but I try to be as fair as possible, and sometimes it's just not super possible with Atari games, and that's really the only system at this point that is like that. I mean, even for 5200 games, like, there's still some worth in some of those, or even the crappy NES games with, you know, just a couple exceptions, I can still, I'll pay something for any NES game, of course, but, you know, there's almost everything else, even the common stuff, even Madden 94, all of that stuff, I can still totally pay people for. It's fine. But Combat for Atari 2600.
But each system, though, has their own combats, right? So, I mean, are you really going to accept, like, World Series Baseball 2003 on PS2? I mean, are
I
you
am.
Really...
I mean, there's
is someone
not...
going to buy that? You will.
Well, I don't... I am under the... Like, my policy is not to turn away anything, but I do try to tell people if they come in and they think that what they have is worth a lot of money and it turns out it's a stack of sports PS2 games, although I will still buy it from them, I, again, try to give them the same, like, hey, you know, I sell these for a dollar and they never sell type thing, you know, so, like, just don't expect to be getting rich off of this, I'm still going to give you something for it. I'm not going to just give hand you a paperclip and expect you to walk away. But, you know,
it's going to be like Funko Land. They give you 10 cents for Mario Duck Hunt in like the mid to late 90s.
I mean, I'm definitely a lot better about that because Mario is still popular. Like, yes, do I have 30 copies of it? Yes, but that's okay because people still buy it. You know, so I can certainly still afford to pay people, you know, $4 or $5 for it because it's something that still sells. And maybe I'll be wrong and, you know, one of these days, like you're saying, that'll be one of the can't give it away games. But I just kinda doubt it because it's Mario and people are always gonna want
yeah,
Mario
that's
for
the
something,
thing.
You know?
I think you're always gonna have those games where this is my always Pat's theory about looking at the games that collectors want versus the modern culture. And I always maintain that a game like Steam Events, 100 years from now, not many people will care about. But you know what? If someone has a sealed first edition original Super Mario Brothers, that could be it. Like, that could be the culturally significant piece that is worth $1 million 100 years from now. Like, that could be the game. Because people will still care about it 100 years from now. And they won't care about Flintstones Dinosaur Peak that much, or Steam Events, or, you know what I mean? Like, it's just, what does that mean? Like, who cares? Oh, wow, the game was rare 100 years ago. It's like, okay, why should I care if it was rare back then, if the game's not that good?
Yeah, no, that's a great point, because the culture is certainly shifting the way that that the market is working, you know? I mean, not to say that prices on popular things have necessarily gone up a lot, or at least not any more than anything else. But you are definitely getting a lot more people who are in it just for kind of a short-term hobby. They want to play, you know, they never go into the actual collecting part. They do just want to pick up what they had as a kid, maybe pick up one or two other games to try them out, and then they're done. Maybe they sell it back, maybe they keep it around for when they have friends over, and they can be like, hey, remember Banjo-Kazooie? You know, bring it out, but not everyone... In fact, most people entering this hobby, I would say, are probably not collectors.
Which again, goes back to maybe people getting just the popular games or the sets. Like, you'll have maybe on each system the core 40 or so games that these are what 90% of the people want.
Right.
The popular games that they want. Like, you can even boil it down to N64. There's probably only 15 to 20 games that people actually will ask
It's true. That's
out of
very
the entire
true.
Library.
Yeah.
And then 50 years from now, who cares about that rare variant? Because I didn't grow up with it. Maybe my grandfather did, but he didn't care. You know, like, so,
right.
But yeah, I'll play Ocarina of Time 75 years from now.
Yeah,
because that's regarded as a classic still.
That's completely right. I mean, unless a game is actually really uncommon or really rare, even on the N64, which right now is, you know, a very popular system, most of the non-Nintendo games or non-rare games, like rares in the company, not rares in its rarity, you know, most of the not fondly nostalgic you know, childhood remembered games are $10 or less, you know?
Sure.
So, I mean, it's probably just going to be the way it stays with a lot of systems. You see the really rare stuff that's for collectors, and those are, you know, $50 to $200, whatever, $1,000. Those are going to be really rare. Then you've got things that hold their value pretty well because people still like them, including non-collectors. Things like, you know, on the N64, Ocarina of Time and Banjo-Kazooie and those types of
things. GoldenEye, Mario Kart.
Exactly, yeah. And then you have just the random... It doesn't even necessarily have to be sports games. It can be like Armorians or, you know... there's a couple that are kind of in that mid area, like Cruisin' USA or something like that, where... Some people fondly remember it, but there's still just so many of them out there that it doesn't really make it expensive. but yeah, I mean, there's tons of stuff on every system that's like that. That's just going to be sub $10 forever.
And maybe that's where it plays out going forward for all the systems, even now. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like you talk about Wii, you're going to have the 20 games that people cared about, and the shovelware will be worthless,
right?
Or you won't give it away.
There's a couple, and there's a couple like rare shovelware things that as long as there are still collectors, those games might still have some value. But
they might care about them. Sure, if you have a Wii collector 20 years from now trying to complete a set, they're going to search those out, so those might maintain the value. But you're going to have 80% of the games just drop.
Yeah,
out
absolutely
because it's going to be like, well, who's really searching out after the shovelware that they produced a billion of them? Where if I go to the swap meet next week, you still find like sometimes boxes of shovelware new, like because they just made so many of it. Anyone put the game out. It was almost like the Atari 2600 with the crash, where hey, you make a game for the Wii to make money, put out that cheap game.
Yep.
You know, just I mean that's almost how it was. Didn't cause a crash.
That's a good
though.
Point.
It just
that's
crashed.
A good point, actually,
kind of crashed the Wii U a bit.
Yeah.
It so are just, you excited? Speaking of.
Oh no! Go ahead.
I was gonna say, are you excited by this resurgence of Nintendo with the Switch?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, like most people, you know, I don't want to call myself like a Nintendo fanboy or anything, but I certainly grew up with Nintendo and, like everyone, have fond memories of Nintendo games. So, of course, you know, I'm going to be excited that they're still doing well into 2018. But the Switch is a console, for me personally, that feels like it was built for me. It feels like it was built... I know, like... like all Nintendo stuff, it's for everybody, it's for all ages, but in my head, the Switch is really built with, like, the adult in mind, someone who doesn't have a ton of time to spend in front of a TV every day, has lots of places to go to and from, maybe they've got, like, a doctor's appointment, they've got to go on the bus, all these things in their daily life, but, you know, they're still gamers, they still want, like, a good... a console that's going to be more powerful than, you know, like a DS or something, right? So I love the Switch so much because I play things primarily in handheld mode if I can because I'm on the go so often. So although I like that I can dock it, my Switch is mostly in handheld mode, and I love that I can take it with me, and it's an actually pretty powerful console as opposed to, you know, all the other handhelds we've seen so far. I mean, the Vita's decently powerful, but it's been really exciting for me to see that handhelds are getting sort of like the adult treatment. They're not just like a toy that you take on the go. They're like, no, we're going to put real full games on this. We're going to put Doom, we're going to put Skyrim, we're going to put a full Zelda huge on it, you know?
I think it's interesting that they re-tapped into a market that everyone forgot about, basically. But yeah, like the handheld market, which was always strong with the 3DS.
Right.
You know, but then they managed through the marketing to go back to maybe a generation ago that hasn't had a Nintendo system since maybe the Wii or even GameCube or even before that and say, hey, Nintendo's around still. Check out what we got now. Check out the Zelda game. Check out Mario Odyssey. Mm-hmm. So you got 30 and 40 year olds like, interesting. I want to buy this system. It's got the little docking thing, and I haven't seen that before. So it's almost, to me, it was almost like the Wii U had to fail miserably for the Switch to be a success.
Yeah, and there's
still... You wouldn't
have
one maybe without the other.
Right, and there's still plenty of things wrong with the Switch. I mean, Nintendo's still behind on the times when it comes to online play.
Yeah. They haven't launched their online service really yet.
Yeah.
They haven't launched it.
you know, there's so many features that the Xbox One and the PS4 have that the Switch doesn't, which is disappointing. But for me, I mean, the biggest thing about game consoles is always the games, right? I mean, that seems pretty obvious, but I think people forget that sometimes, and they get lost in the specs and the features and that sort of thing. But, you know, games are really what's the most important draw for most people getting a console. So the fact that they're bringing these sort of adult, not necessarily adult as in, like, you know, rated M games, but games that really feel like they can be enjoyed by, you know, the same way that you're enjoying games on an Xbox One or a PS4. These really long, complete games, they don't necessarily have, like, I mean, I play a lot of JRPGs, but, you know, you can fit the anime graphics and that sort of thing on a 3DS, but something more intense, graphically intense than that, something a little bit more, adult is the word I keep using, but I don't know if that's the right word, but it seems like it's kind of grown up a little bit with the Switch.
Oh, sure. That makes sense. And it's something that is a new party system with the Joy-Cons. And so Nintendo hit upon that the other major competitors were totally ignoring, having an in-person party console. That really hasn't existed in a long time. And it's been a gigantic hit. And Nintendo, along those lines, has recognized the retro gaming community and the value of producing more Super Nintendo classics and bringing back the NES Classic. And then also offering an online sort of Netflix service when they eventually roll it out on the Switch. So they're learning more quickly than I thought they ever would have, and actually correcting errors, which is good news for us.
That's the important part. I don't mind, you know, I don't cut off a company forever when they make a really horrible mistake. I mean, everyone remembers that Xbox One E3 announcement, right? But they corrected everything that, you know, people were pissed, and they went, okay, people are pissed, we're going to go back on all of these things then and revise them. So as long as you're doing that, then, I mean, I can't really ask for anything more, right? Just listen to the people and what the frustrations they have and try to correct them.
Yeah, I still think I picture myself, Reggie with a baseball bat like Negan, going over to Nintendo Japan and just smashing it down on the table. Say, you're going to make more Super Nintendo Classics. You will make more NES Classics.
Yeah.
And they said, okay, Reggie, all right. He's crazy. He's nuts. Because they're more in tune Nintendo America, where you are, with what's going on here versus in Japan. So I think they just had to communicate, and they probably butted heads for a while. And plus, the shareholders probably got involved and said, we're throwing away money not making as many of these as we possibly can.
Yep.
Like, that's what we're doing. Like, they would have sold 10 million NES Classic Editions if they made them last Christmas in 2016. And they said they made two. They made 2 million.
Yeah.
It's like, come on. Man. So what's next for you on your channel besides your you revealed some of it. What's going on?
Yeah.
The entertainment video.
So the next couple videos are going to be that. And then I also went to the National Video Game Museum in Frisco, Texas over like the Christmas time. I went a little bit before Christmas. So I'm going to do...
Interesting.
Yeah. Have you been there?
No, I always forget when I go to Retropalooza in Arlington, it's not too far.
Yeah, no, it's not far from Arlington at all.
You might have seen someone shooting a certain documentary out there, because I think they were out there around Christmas or right afterwards.
Really?
It could have been
overlapping, that's funny.
Potentially.
I met John Hardy, who is one of the museum's founders at Portland
Very
Retro.
Nice guy.
Yeah, super nice guy. And so I basically just emailed him when I was, a couple weeks out, and I said, hey, I'm coming in town. Would love to see you and see the museum and that sort of thing. So he ended up giving me just kind of like a full tour, showed me a little bit of the like secret backroom area, which sounds really cool and exciting, but you know, it's mostly just storage, right? So, I'm doing a video on that about, you know, what the museum is like. It's not a full tour because I obviously don't want to take away anyone who's like on the fence about going. If you can see absolutely everything, what's the point in going? So I'm leaving some of it out, of course, but showing off some of the exhibits and some of the really, really cool stuff they have there. And then talking a little bit about what I saw in the back room. He obviously didn't let me film back there, but But there were a couple interesting things back there.
I picture it being like Digital Press in New Jersey, one of the largest and one of my most favorite retro gaming stores I've ever been to. Downstairs, you have enough stuff downstairs to open probably two more retro gaming stores, like just in storage. It's insane.
Well, that's Joe Santulli's store, isn't it? He's also one of the founders of the National Video Game Museum. So that's cool.
Him and Sean Kelly.
Yep.
Yep.
So
I've known Joe Santulli for like almost 10 years. Probably.
Have you really? Wow. He seems like I have not met him, but he seems like a really nice guy.
Oh, he's an OG of the collecting scene and opening up game stores. And yeah, he's a great guy. he lived down. He was helping live in Texas, and he went back to Jersey to run the shop again, I think, a year or two ago.
Yeah, it's now just John down there. But he seems to be...
So that's good. And you'll be streaming on Twitch as well, some stuff in the future?
Yeah, I'm streaming once a week. This is a totally new thing for me. I've never streamed before, and I'm definitely still getting the hang of it. I started the stream because I really want to stream Monster Hunter when it comes out. It's a game I've been playing for a long time, and the new one is especially awesome. Got to play, the demos that have come out the last couple weekends. So I think... That's sort of what it's gearing up to, because that's a more exciting game than what I've been playing recently, which is mostly just like JRPGs, which don't stream very well. But so once a week streaming, it may increase eventually, but the reason I got into streaming was because I know my YouTube my YouTube channel doesn't put out videos very often. So I want to make sure I still have something I'm doing that people can engage with, so I'm not just someone who pops up every month or two with one video.
Is that the future? You think that's the future, where even if you have someone like me on YouTube that, like the Stay in Events video will come out, something like that can only come out once every 2 to 3 months because of all the time that goes into it. So while that's going on, you just go to Twitch and hang out and play games.
Yeah.
And see your face. And
I know you've had Norm on the gaming historian on your podcast here, and I think that's sort of what he does, because his videos also, similarly take a very long time to research and write and produce. And I know he streams now too, and I'm not sure if that was his motivation for doing it or not, but I would imagine it seems likely, right? Like, for someone who can't put out a video every single week or twice a week, that it's just another way to make sure that you're putting your face out there and getting probably a little bit of extra income too. I have not made a whole lot of money on Twitch yet, but I've gotten a handful of donations, and I'm thankful for that. So it was something, right? Something to motivate me to continue going.
It's also a good excuse to play games for fun. I mean, I'm used to, in my line of work and for working on these books, like it's fun, but it's still work.
Right.
So at least with Twitch, I mean, there's a lot of people treat it as a job, but at least you're playing games for fun. And you have an audience there. They're in the chat. They're having fun. So it actually appeals to me a lot more than I originally thought about it even a couple of years ago. Where I was like, for example, I was always kind of down in general on Let's Play videos, uploaded to YouTube. Because to me, the value of those wasn't like, to me, an inherent value of that. But with Twitch, where it's a live performance and people are hanging out, that at least means something to me. And that's something I always like doing, going back to all these NES marathons with you once a year. I actually like playing these games. It's just, maybe you make it more of a regular part of your life. You build a community that way off of YouTube, and the Twitch community, by and large, is far more positive, at least in my estimation and knowledge, than the YouTube community. They can be a little nasty on YouTube sometimes, as you might know.
Yeah, I've only had positive. I mean, again, I've only streamed twice, but so far it's been nothing but positive, so... knock on wood, but it seems to be going well so far.
Well, great. Where can people find you on Twitch and on YouTube?
So I wish I had kept it all the branding consistent, but it's a little bit different. So my YouTube is just Kelsey Lewin. So it's, youtube.com/Kelsey Lewin, or you can just search my name. On Twitch, I am twitch.tv/tentakels. So it's like the word tentacles, but K-E-L-S, like my name. And then on Twitter, I'm at Kels Lewin, so similar to my YouTube channel. Branding's all over the place, unfortunately. I wish I had been a little bit more consistent.
I'll put a link or two down there. People will find it. And of course, you are running the awesome Pink Gorilla Games in two locations in the Seattle area. So if you're around there, you know, check out Pink Gorilla. They're good people. And a certain NES guidebook is there for sale.
It is. Too, and so I work there. Like 5 days a week. So sometimes people are surprised to see me there. I'm like, no, this is my job. I do have to be here. So
that's how you make that money. So you can buy those weird esoteric exercise Super Nintendo bikes. Otherwise, you can't do that. Well, Kelsey, it was great talking with you. I hope to see you again at a convention or two this year. And I'll keep up with your work online.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me on.
And that's it for this edition of the Not So Common Podcast. Thanks again to Kelsey for speaking to me this week. If you enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe on YouTube or on your podcast platform of choice, whether it's Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play, Podbean, or whatever you use to listen to them. You can like the podcast, leave a comment to help give it a boost, and also feel free to share your experience on social media. Follow me at Pat the NES Punk on Twitter. And also, I have a Patreon if you want to help directly support me and my work. It's patreon.com/patcountry. Thanks, and I'll see you next time.